This is Amy Cargis, co-host of the MDJ podcast. Make subscribe and join Darren Sutherland and me every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday for hyper-local news and information about Marietta, Cobb, and surrounding areas. Tell your friends and never miss an episode of the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Now here's Katie Ruth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sunday Cobb Life podcast. This is Cobb Life editor Katie Ruth Camp, and I am joined today with Trevor Beeman. Trevor is the executive director of Cobb Landmarks and Historical Society, and he was also one of our 20 under 40 winners for the Cobb Life list this year. So welcome, Trevor.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So for people who are unfamiliar with you and what Cobb Landmarks does, I mean, probably the gist of what people think is they say old houses, right?
Yeah.
But you do a lot more, and you have a lot more at the Root House on the Square and all the other structures that you're there. So kind of talk about what the organization itself does.
Sure. So Cobb Landmarks was founded by people in the community in the 1970s, kind of as a reaction to the courthouse in Marietta.
Which people are still mad about. Yeah.
So, it's historic preservation for houses and private residences, but also for downtown areas. We're located centrally in Marietta, but we try to work with cities throughout the county.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the county itself, just kind of identify the sites and buildings that are most relevant to Cobb County's history and trying to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, my approach is, we're here to help people. I think the tendency most people sometimes they think of preservationists like chaining themselves to buildings and things. And I would much rather, just reach out to people and say, hey, you might not even realize this is a super significant building or site.
Mm-hmm.
And is there something we can do, together to mm-hmm. try to save it or come up with a good solution for it?
Because I know it was a couple of years ago, and I lived off of Session Street, so I would often walk to the square for work down Church Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I sent you a picture or posted a picture or something. It was like this beautiful little cottage that, and there was a huge bulldozer that was just like going after
it.
And I was like, oh no, I live in an old house. I love old houses. Yeah. And so there's just nothing more heartbreaking than seeing something that could be treasured by somebody being just decimated.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of red tape around those types of things, right?
There is. And a lot of it just takes education. And mm-hmm. And sometimes it takes something like that to kind of upset people.
Yeah.
So I know about that time the city of Marietta was working on trying to establish a local historic district.
Right.
So there are already a lot of national register districts, but mm-hmm. the national register doesn't protect properties. So that's a big misconception. A lot of people think, oh, it's on the National Register. It can't be torn down.
Yeah.
That's not true.
It's going to be there forever.
Yeah. So it has to have local designation. So they were working on creating a Church Cherokee Historic District
mm-hmm.
under the city of Marietta.
Mm-hmm.
And it was coming up to when people were going to be voting on it. And you have to have a majority of the property owners in the proposed district agree to being on it. And so I think, having properties like that come down
mm-hmm.
It upsets enough people to where if people were on the fence about it, they're kind of like, okay.
And it was about the same time. I think it was also – it was either Church or Cherokee that there was the big house that had a huge fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the opposite happened where this family came in and they actually restored it
and renovated
it.
And that took a lot too because it was
– because it was almost pretty much just a shell, right?
And it was going to be demolished really.
Mm-hmm.
So it took, this family with the vision to come in and try to revive it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think the same time the cottage went down that you were talking about, that's the same time that the house next to Kenneth Stone Hospital, where McAllister's is, went down.
Yeah.
So I think there were just a few buildings all at once that were kind of threatened, and it kind of just got kind of people to perk up.
Yeah, sometimes it does take things like that, unfortunately, for people to be like, wait.
Yeah.
I thought, this pretty old house, there's nothing wrong with it, would be there forever.
And the other thing, before I worked at Cobb Landmarks, I worked at the Atlanta History Center in Buckhead mm-hmm. for 8 years. And, people were buying these, Schutze or Neil Reed 1820s mansions. Or, 1920s.
Yeah.
These buying these 1920s mansions and tearing them down. And it's You know, these are multi-million dollar houses.
Yeah, I remember that.
I think a lot of people in Marietta and in other cities too, Ackworth, Kennesaw, they see these historic homes and like, oh, well, this is you know, $500,000 house. Nobody's going to buy this to tear it down. And that's not true. You know,
eventually, if they want the property enough, they will.
The land gets valuable enough or the lot's large enough that they can tear that down and build two or three houses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not just safe enough for people to assume, you know, that the house itself is valuable enough because that's not always the case. And especially moving forward as property values just keep climbing.
Right.
So.
Well, and, you know, I'm so thankful to have people like you that you know, really cherish that and work hard to save that. Because I know when I was in college, I studied abroad at Oxford University. So I was living in Oxford for a couple months. And I was just amazed how every building there has been preserved for like centuries, not even, you know, talking about 1800s. I mean, like the cottage I lived in was like a monk's cottage in the 1400s.
Wow.
And the Pizza Hut where we would go because it was the only place you could get an iced Diet Coke and some decent food sometimes. It was in a building that was like from the 1400s, you know. So
that's cool.
It was just so cool to see how as a country they really cherished and protected all of those old buildings when it would have been so easy, I'm sure, to tear down and build new.
It's a lot different in Europe. I think preservation and museums are supported more by national and state and local governments, where in America it's set up a little different where it's kind of all privately funded more. And so, it's a little different to try to get people behind preservation efforts, you know, large scale ones.
Well, and it just scares me because as a country, we're still fairly young.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're tearing down things that were considered too old and they were built in the early 1900s, like what's going to happen the next 200 years? Are we going to have things that are relevant to our history that are still here like they have in Europe if it's just easier and cheaper to keep tearing down and building new?
Yeah. And I mean, that's something that when you look at a building like the Root House, which now is, you know, the oldest house remaining in downtown Marietta.
Right.
You know, when it was built, it wasn't. And there's a time, you know, people today, they kind of laugh. You look at like 1940s and 50s and 60s, even ranch homes and things like that. They kind of scoff at them. Well, there was a time where somebody looked at the Root House and said, ugh. You know, it's like this house is like 80 years old. It's not super old, but it's not.
Right.
So like, you know, this is just an old, gross house. And so it's a cyclical thing. And so, yeah, I mean, today, even when we go and try to defend things that are, you know, most people wouldn't consider super old, they might be, you know, still something that's relevant and needs to be preserved because in another 50 years or 60 years, there might not be that many because everybody remodeled them or tore them down or –
Well, and trends are so cyclical, too. I mean, you know, right now we're having a huge moment with like 70s homes and, you know, that mid-century modern type art, which in the 80s, people were probably, like you said, like, ugh.
Yeah.
Why would anybody buy this house? We should just tear it down.
Sure. And the other thing, too, that is important with all of it, and part of it is probably just out of necessity because we're not a large institution, but the difference between historic and historical. So, you know, for us, the priority, you know, has to be with our limited resources, things that are historic, which so that it's something that is an important structure, something important happened
there. So you have like a documented history.
Yeah, somebody, you know, significant lived there or it's a rare style of building or something like that. Historical just means that it's old. So not everything that's historical, you know, we need to or we are able to throw our entire weight behind.
Good Lord. You don't have enough hours in the day to say.
Well, no, we're a private nonprofit. So, you know, we rely on donations and stuff like that. We have a small, you know, staff. So, you know, it might be something where somebody emails us and, you know, we can help them as best we can. But it might not be something where we can go call, you know, a news crew out for. We have to save those for things that are super
that are very important. Yeah. Well, and I know you mentioned you guys work throughout Cobb County, but you're headquartered in Marietta. And for people that have maybe gone to the Marietta Square Market and they're like, why is this random old house in the parking lot?
Yeah.
That's you.
Yeah.
So you have the William Root House. And then I know you guys just finished like a $500,000 expansion of the property because you've got the cabin, you've got the smokehouse, and you've got the cookhouse there as well. Talk a little bit about those properties and what you actually do there as well.
So it literally is a parking lot. So the Root House originally was located when it was built across from St. James Church. Mm-hmm. And then they moved it in the 1890s to build what is Mike Whittle's building now. It was a library back
then. Yeah, it's kind of a funky looking building off of Church Street.
So they moved the Root House in the 1890s, and then it was moved again in 1990.
Oh my gosh, how many times did that house be moved?
So it was moved to where it currently is on the loop in 1990, and then in 1996 they rebuilt what would have been the cookhouse based on insurance records.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2018 we built started on the plans to build our expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the expansion was based on the insurance records was to rebuild a smokehouse that would have been there. And then also there was a two-story wood structure on the records marked as a dwelling. And we know that they had a slave dwelling on the property.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea was to bring the cabin in and use part of that space to interpret the lives of enslaved people that were living at the Root House property. And then, too, we were kind of confined. We had been focusing on bringing in new programming at the Root House with the museum there. And so we had increased our attendance 400% in just a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were running these programs, we were kind of running out of space. And so in addition to bringing in the cabin, it was to build a new building with some offices and a meeting space and public restrooms. We had never had public restrooms for our guests.
Yeah.
So
always need that, right?
Yeah, yeah. So like we have our beer festival, you know, we'd have 150 people and like a little residential toilet inside the Root House was not going to work. So and then also we were able to add a gift shop. Well, we had one in the Root House. It was very tiny. So this is more of a dedicated retail space. And really that's helped us kind of diversify and, mm-hmm. and sustain us a little bit through the pandemic and everything, being able to keep running that.
Well, but the pandemic was kind of a buzzkill for you guys, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you had just
everything
really
was
finished
just
everything.
Finished. And we were able to open in December. So we had, you know, two or three good months.
Yeah.
And us before we had to close down, but we had the ribbon cutting scheduled for, you know, in the middle of the pandemic. So we had to cancel that. And so, you know, towards the end of summer, we reopened and, you know, we put in place, you know, all the safety measures we needed to. But one of the good things for us was part of the expansion is we installed interactive touchscreens throughout the entire museum. So every single room in the house and the cookhouse and the slave quarters has a touchscreen in it.
Mm-hmm.
That tells you about the room. There are kind of funny videos that people can watch that kind of poke fun at the 19th century.
And,
but all of that was put in. And the good thing is, you know, with COVID, now we can still have people tour the house and they're touring it on their own. We don't have to have docents and volunteers in there with them.
Which is good for now because, you know, you'd have to maintain 6 feet.
Yes.
And people are weary of that. And
so we just, you know, they get a stylus pen, they go tour the museum and they bring the stylus pen back when they're done and we sanitize it. And, it works really well. It was really lucky that happened, that we put all of that stuff into place. There's just been a trend in general. Most people tend to like able to explore on their own.
Yeah.
And then with house museums, a lot of times people who tour house museums tour them a lot. And so they end up hearing the same stories about chamber pots and, you know, rope beds and all that stuff. And they kind of like, okay, awesome. So we have that information on there, but we really focus a lot more on the family and their experiences and the experiences of the enslaved people that worked in Marietta focusing on kind of the social issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also that it wasn't rosy. And we talk about PTSD and suicide and child abandonment with the Root's grandchildren. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of issues that people still deal with today. Mm-hmm. And a lot of house museums, I think, tend to kind of just present something that's kind of very beautiful, and the rooms are put together like they're a show house, and mm-hmm. everything was simpler back then. And so for us, you know, we try to tell the actual story of these people, and the rooms look a little disheveled, and there's stuff out, and it looks like they left the house.
They actually lived there.
So that's the way that we try to present.
And right now, is the house in mourning?
So we changed the house out all throughout the year. So it came out of summer interpretation. Which, you know, they slip cover everything in white, and they put matting down over the floors, and really it was about protecting the fabrics mm-hmm. from the sun and dirt and everything. But so October we switch it to mourning. Hannah Root's father lived with the family and died in the house in the mm-hmm. 1850s. So we set up a Victorian funeral for him, basically. So the whole house is dark, and you know, the curtains are closed, and there's black crepe on everything that's reflective. And we have the casket in the parlor. And so, and then we've been doing flashlight tours on Saturday nights. So we turn off all the lights, and it's kind of, it's creepy, but it's not scary.
Yeah.
And it's informative. And then, you know, Christmas, we'll decorate the house. And so we just try to do things throughout the year that people can say, you know, I've been there.
Right.
I've seen it. Well, you know, in 2 months from now, it's going to look completely different. So,
and because Halloween is upon us, and because I've heard stories before, is the Root House really haunted?
I know the story everybody always shares is that there's a bed upstairs where the mattress always kind of smushed down.
Right.
And we fluff it back up and it gets smushed back down again. And
as if someone was sitting on it.
Yeah. I think a part of when we put in the touchscreens, we put in some barriers so that people don't
try to mess with it.
Into the rooms. And so it hasn't happened as much.
Okay.
But I always tell people, I've been there. I started at the Root House when I was a volunteer when I was 12. Like nothing really has ever happened. And if it was haunted, I have like a list of questions that I'm ready to ask them.
like, please be haunted.
I'm ready.
I really want to find out.
I would love to talk to you all about some of this stuff.
Well, great. We're going to take a quick break and we will be back with Trevor Buhn. Okay, we are back with Trevor, and we were just talking about the Root House, and you touched on it a little bit, but you know, the fall season and the holiday season are usually pretty big time for you guys at the actual property.
Yeah.
You mentioned the beer festival, and we'll get into the pilgrimage home tour in a little bit too. Are you still going to have the beer festival? What are you guys kind of changing up this year?
So we're waiting on the A-OK for the permit, but we're looking at—
Because it's outside.
Yeah.
It's not as—
What we're looking at is breaking it up. So it'll be 3 2-hour shifts with a limited number of people, tickets sold for each shift. We're going to color code the tickets so we know if you've stayed too long, you're not part of this group.
You're kicking it out.
Yes. And then we always give people a commemorative beer glass with our logo and Red Hair's logo. So we're going to save those for the end and just use disposable glasses so the bartenders aren't handling used glasses while they're pouring. Instead of doing food, we've worked out with the Meredith Square Market. They're providing everyone with a coupon book for the market for restaurants in there. So it's a little different this year. It's our sixth year doing it. And so we're hoping, you know, people are still excited about it and want to show up even though it's going to be a little different.
It's such a neat thing. I think I've been a couple of times the past couple of years. I know Laura Higginbotham, who is a big supporter of y'all's, she and I usually go.
Yeah.
But for people who are unfamiliar, it's really cool because you guys actually use stuff out of the Root House garden. And then you pair with Red Hair Brewing, which is also based in Marietta. And they create beers based off of the things that you have.
So we grow hops, centennial hops in the garden. And so I harvest those and then they'll go through every year. We provide them a list of all the fruits and herbs and vegetables that are growing, and they kind of select from those things to come up with these beers. And they're only available really at this tasting. So people who are like beer aficionados and like craft beer and locally made things, it's really neat to be able to stand there and drink the beer and, you know, look over at the plant that the ingredients were from. So it's a really neat experience, and we're super lucky
to have
Red Hair.
And it's a big fundraiser for y'all as well, right?
Yeah, it is. And each year it's grown, you know, tremendously. I think, you know, the first year we started up with like 40 people and then 75 and then 150. So like we're looking forward to this year, but I'm looking forward, you know, hopefully next year we'll be able to continue growing it. This year too is the first year we've moved it to a Saturday, and we're starting it at 2 p.m. So I'm hoping, and maybe it's just because I have kids now, but I'm hoping that we'll be able, between the three shifts, you know, maybe bring in some people with kids and dogs or whatever, you know, for the earlier ones, and just let it kind of shift till 8 p.m. to a younger crowd, or maybe, you know, I won't want a rowdy crowd at the Root House, but, you know, just a different vibe.
Yeah,
and so moving it to a Saturday, making it longer and starting earlier, you know, I hope more people feel welcome at the event.
Well, and something else that you guys are known for is the Pilgrimage Home Tour, which you partner with the Marietta Visitors Bureau each year to put that on. And I know, you know, I've been a docent several years, and they're just people from all over that come to this. It's a huge deal. And for people who haven't been before, you guys usually select a district of Marietta or a neighborhood or a street, and it's maybe what, usually about 8 or 9 homes?
6 homes, usually, and then about 10 or so public buildings.
Right. And they're all older homes, you know, and so the docents are actually there to tell the story so people can tour them, but they're decorated for Christmas. And, you know, who doesn't like to see a pretty old house decorated for Christmas? But this year, obviously, people are probably like, I don't want all these people in my house because COVID. So you're doing it a little different this year, right?
Yeah. I mean, so usually we have, you know, 2,000, 2,500 people come through.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah, in 2 days. So can't have that. So what we came up with is we moved the tour this year back to Church in Cherokee, just because it's a great walkable area with a lot of houses. And so what we're doing is we're working with homeowners, and we're just going to have a walking tour. So it'll be a walking tour book that can be purchased from the Root House or the Welcome Center. And it'll have photos of the houses and histories about them, and then any information the family wants to share about their decorations. And then people who take the tour, you know, they can look at the houses and then pick which ones they think, based on, you know, 3 different categories, which ones they think had the best decorations. So we're going to have, you know, one for a light display, who has the best light display, traditional. And then kind of like a over-the-top award as well. And then we're also going to have a scavenger hunt. So if people or families have kids or, you know, older folks want to do a scavenger hunt too, but hiding some things around to just make it a little more engaging. And so hopefully and again, it's a big fundraiser for us. For Cobb Landmarks, the pilgrimage is usually about a third of our operating budget for the year. So you know, the sponsors we've talked to who have supported it in the past are still interested in supporting it.
Because what year will this be? Because it's in the 30s, right?
Yeah. 34th or 35th.
That's what. So for 35 years, I mean, this has been a big deal. And I know a lot of people love to do it because it's almost like it kind of kicks off the holiday season for you.
Yeah.
You
know,
it's usually pretty cool outside. So you put on your sweaters and, you know, dress up for Christmas and walk around and tour all these Christmassy homes. And so I know a lot of people are going to be just as sad as you guys are to not have the traditional structure of what it's been.
I know a lot of people are bummed, but they understand.
And the gala, like that's always like,
so we'll be doing a virtual gala. So we're working with Carriage House Catering, who usually caters the gala. And so we'll be doing something where people can purchase their dinner and it can be delivered to their house, or they can go by Carriage House and pick up their dinner. And we'll have some interactive stuff on social media going for that as well. So we're trying the best we can to kind of keep it similar to what people are accustomed to.
Right.
But and then the other thing nice with the walking tour is it doesn't have dates. You know, the pilgrimage is usually the first Saturday and Sunday.
It's just the 2 days,
So this is something where starting, you know, Black Friday, basically, they can purchase these books and go out with their families and, you know, pretty much any of the time of the day. If you want to go in the evening and see the lights, if you want to go during the day, you know, for
weeks. And how much are the books?
The tour books can be purchased for $25, and we'll have them available online so people can pick them up or we can mail them out to.
And can they also go by the Root House or the Visitor Center?
Yeah, they can come by the Welcome Center or the Root House and pick them up. Just encourage people to kind of check our hours because we run different hours than the Welcome Center does.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about you, Trevor, for people who are unfamiliar with your background. How does one get into preservation? How did this become a passion of yours?
I think I was just a weird kid. So.
Weren't we all?
Yeah. I guess the good thing is my parents kind of encouraged me. So when I was a little kid, I liked going and looking at old cemeteries and going to museums and stuff.
Did you have like a metal detector on the back?
No, but I would have been out there digging. I think too, just growing up in the area, there's a lot of battlefield parks and museums. Mm-hmm. And when I was a little kid, we grew up near the Lost Mountain Store. So I remember when that was being rehabbed and in first grade, we went to the Atlanta History Center and saw that and the farm and all that stuff in school on a field trip. And so that's when I kind of fell in love with museums and things. And we tried to find something local, a museum that I could get involved in as a child. Mm-hmm. And so the Root House actually had, and we still have it, it's called a junior docent program. So we allow elementary, middle school, high school kids to come and learn how to give tours. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. And I was also in Boy Scouts. So I did my Eagle Scout project at the Root House, which is an exhibit kind of about the lives of children during that time period. Because that was something I noticed when I was giving tours is they just talked about the furnishings and then William and Hannah, the parents. They didn't really ever talk about the kids. So I wanted to kind of add that part of the story to it. But so I volunteered there. And then I went to Kennesaw State. While I was at Kennesaw State, I went and worked at the Southern Museum. And then my last year at Kennesaw State, I got a job at the Atlanta History Center and somehow worked a full-time job at the History Center while finishing school.
Oh, my gosh.
But it worked. It was a lot of driving.
I was going to say, that's easily a 30-minute drive, not in traffic,
gosh.
Right?
The worst one was the Great Flood. It took me 7 hours to get home that
gosh,
day.
Really?
Yeah, it was bad. But it was cool to get back to get a job, get hired at the History Center because, like I said, that was like one of the first places we visited in elementary school that kind of started it all for me. So it was really cool to get to work there. And I worked in the marketing communications. Back then they had an in-house marketing department. I did the website, I did the social media platforms, and then I did the graphic design. So, and when people ask about that, it's, you know, I do the exhibits to the billboards to the toilet broken signs. You know, we did a little bit of everything. So it was really cool to get to work there. And I think the neat experience with working in the marketing department was we got to work with all the other departments where, you know, sometimes if you were in education or you were in visitor services or in finance, you were kind of in your silo.
Mm-hmm.
Where marketing, we had to work with everybody. So it was really neat to kind of get
to see
how it
all worked. So you kind of learned all the aspects. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the Southern Museum was the same way. I started there in the admissions desk, and then I started working in education some, and then they, you know, had me help them with exhibit installs. And then before I left, I started doing some graphic design for them too. So and a lot of times the museums are small enough that you have to be able to do all these different things because there's nobody else there to do them. So
the beauty of a nonprofit.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and today, I mean, I'm the executive director, but I scrub the toilet, and you know, for the beer festival, I'll be setting up the tables and chairs, and then I'll attend the event, and then I'll clean up the trash afterwards. You know, so you have to find people who are passionate where this stuff's a labor of love for them, and for me, it is. So.
And you actually live in an old house, right? You
yeah.
And your wife and kids?
So our house, it's always driven me crazy. So we live in downtown Acworth, and the construction of the house looks quite old, but it's dated and all the records to the 1960s. And so we were always trying to figure out, you know, was it moved there?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes when homes were moved or remodeled, if they were remodeled enough, the county would just redate them.
Yeah.
And so that's it's always driven us crazy. And so it was really cool. I mean, I've even had Georgia State University preservation students come and look at the house to try to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, during quarantine, I was taking the trash out or something, and a car slowed down, and the guy said, "Hey, my family lived in this house in the 60s. They were the first people to move in." And I asked him, I was like, "Well, it's got, you know, lathe marks on the wood, and the joists have saw marks on them from where they were playing." Like,
yeah,
it's not construction from the 60s. And he said, "Well, my uncle built this house, and it was actually a house in Atlanta, and he took it apart and rebuilt it here in Ackworth."
Oh, okay.
And he didn't know much about
that
where it came
house?
From.
Yeah.
So he said he was going to talk to his mother and come back by because he didn't live close.
Uh-huh.
But so I'm waiting for him to come back, but it would be cool to see where it came from in Atlanta and how old it really was.
Yeah. I mean, that's always so interesting. So I bought my house off the Marietta Square in February, and it was dated in the 60s as well. But my inspector, who's really awesome, he actually mentioned, because he was up in the attic, and he was like, okay, this wasn't built in the 60s for sure, because I guess the way the 2x4s were like 2x2s up there and stuff. And he could actually see the remnants of like two old chimneys and everything. So I guess in Marietta, what he mentioned is the courthouse burned, or a lot of records burned in the 60s. And so anything that was built before and that just had a paper record they didn't know when it was built, so they just were like, "Well, we'll make it 1960s." But he was like, "My best guess would be to say this was like early 1900s."
Yeah.
So I was like, "Sweet."
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard that from a few properties that if they didn't have a date, they just put a date on it.
So do you help people with that too? Like, if they aren't sure about the history of their house, do you help them kind of figure out what that history might be?
Yeah, I mean, we can go through and try to look in the deed room to see if there's anything that can be helpful. The other thing is the state has a great website where they've gone through and done a survey of any building they deem historic. And they put a file for each of the houses, and those can be searched by address. So a lot of times if I get an email or somebody calls, I'm already pulling that website up to look at it for them, to pull it up.
And what website is that?
Georgia's Natural Archaeological and Historic Resources, GIS. So it's GNAHRGIS.org.
Man, you would have thought they could have come up with a better.
Well, it's the government.
Yeah.
So it pulls up a map, and you can kind of toggle between like what are the types of things that you want to look for. But you can zoom in and try to find things that way on the streets, or you can try to put in the address. Sometimes if you put in specific address, it can't find it. So if you'll take away like street or road. If it still can't find it, if you'll take the address number away and just search the street. Because sometimes the address numbers even change.
Right.
Some of these surveys are from the 70s, so, you know, but some of them are more current. But that helps a lot too. They try to put who built it if they know. They put a description of the house, any original things of note about the house, the date it was constructed. So there's some really useful information on that, and it's a good starting point at least.
Cool. Are there any properties that you guys are currently working on trying to save, or are there any active?
Probably the one that I've been working on for a few years is the McAfee House.
Okay. Where is that?
Over by Town Center Mall behind Barnes & Noble.
Yeah,
it's like
I know where you're talking
Piedmont.
About. I've seen that before because it's like right there at the corner, right?
Yes. So it's a great this 2-acre property. It's an antebellum home. It was used during the
Prime
Civil War.
Prime for commercial development, right?
Yeah, and it's about listed for about $2 million.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And so we've been working with the listing agent for a few years on that property. And I think what we're going to end up trying to do is find somebody who will relocate the house somewhere safe and refurbish it as a residence.
Because when was it built?
It was built in the 1840s.
Oh, wow.
So it's an early home, super significant for that area. And then the fact that it was used during the Civil War, it was used as a field hospital. So there are several reports that there are our blood stains upstairs on the floor.
Have you actually been in the house?
I've been in it. There's carpet over the floor, so and the house is still full of furniture, so you can't really see very much. It's been covered – like a lot of stuff's been covered up. They put like particle board up over the walls and put carpet down over the floor. So the original house is under there. You just can't really see it very well. But we did crawl down into the basement, the crawl space.
Ooh. Yeah, it was creepy. I hope it was like 10 a.m. and bright out or something.
It was amazing because then you could really see the construction. It's just giant logs that have been used for all the framing and to see you know, the axe marks where this wood's been shaped. And you could really see everything as original because it hadn't been touched. It's the basement. So to know that all of that is underneath all the stuff upstairs, you know, whoever gets the house and takes out the drop ceilings and pulls back that particle board wall and the red shag carpet and all that stuff, there's great heart pine wood under there that's just really cool.
And I love that trend has kind of come back. You know, the 80s, it was all about like wallpaper and carpet.
Yeah.
But now it seems like people are like opening up, you know, the ceilings and taking all of that out. So you, even in like commercial buildings, like I know the loft on the Marietta Square, I know Bonnie mentioned when she tore down all the little office walls and the ceiling, there was this gorgeous exposed wood and even like a, you know, a little
skylight
daylight coming in. So it seems like people are kind of going back to
a lot of people want to see the materials.
Yeah.
And part of having a historic building is the historic materials and reusing them and recycling. I mean, rehabbing a historic building is the best thing for the environment because the materials were already made.
Right.
They're existing. And a lot of times they're better quality than what you can get now.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the heart pine that this house is made out of, it's so dense that, you know, termites don't want it. And it's just like a rock.
When
you try to nail into it or anything like that, it's just some of the best lumber that you could get today. You can't find it. So to have a house built out of heart pine, the floors, walls, ceilings, frame, everything.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's so valuable.
Yeah, and my house is made of a lot of that. And I know the inspector, like we kind of call it my fun house because it definitely slopes in some areas. But he was like, I was down there, you know, that's just natural. But this house isn't going anywhere. It was so well built.
And that's the thing. I mean, even if you do have some, you know, part of the education is educating people who like old houses and they want to live in one is that when you buy it, don't make it a new house. Like. Don't go in and try to level everything out because it's not supposed to be leveled out.
Yeah.
You can go in and put a jack in the basement to support it where it is.
Right.
But, you know, when you start trying to level something out, it's going to start cracking and things are going to start sagging.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's settled that way because that's the way it wants to settle, you know.
Which was fun and all until I decided to put up wallpaper on two of the walls. By myself. It was peel and stick, thank goodness. But it definitely got to the point where it was like, okay, this isn't going to be perfect.
You've got to measure and it's just the way it is. Yeah, when we put in the barriers in the rooms at the root house. You know, when you're in the rooms, you don't realize, but upstairs, when you put the barriers in, you see that they're really sloping towards the middle of the room. And the house looks like, I mean, when you're inside, it's definitely like bowing down a little bit, but like it's the framing and it's just settled over time. And I mean, it's hard as a rock. It's not going anywhere. And we've even had people photograph the root house and they go into Photoshop afterwards because it drives them crazy. So the right-hand front of the house leans forward, but the left side doesn't. So they go in and they're in there trying to fix, you know, the vertical lines in this photo and line everything up so it's plumb. And they're like, I can't figure it out because when I move that wall, then the windows are not right. And it's and I have to tell them, well, actually the house leans on that side and that's just the way it is. So you're never going to get it to look absolutely straight. But yeah, I mean, that's the risk with, you know, talking about it being popular, this type of house now with HGTV and all that stuff. People want to go in and buy an old house and they want shiplap and they want all these things. And so it's important with a historic house that you try to, I mean, for me, I mean, obviously you have to live in the house. I'm a realist, but that you don't try to go in and put a style or features onto this house that it wasn't built for. Like don't go buy this beautiful Victorian house and remodel it to look like a farmhouse, because it wasn't built to be a farmhouse.
Right.
If you want a farmhouse, go find one. And that's part of the historic districts too. When people go and they want to make a change to the exterior of their home, it needs to be something that would have been on that home, a feature that would have been there or is existing on another home that's similar to yours. Mm-hmm. So if you go on and want to add a porch on there, then look at some of your neighbors' porches and see what they look like and try to come up with something that complements that or looks similar, because that might be what was there.
Definitely, because sometimes you see these older houses that maybe didn't have those regulations or didn't try to be true to that. And you're like, God, that looks so weird to have like this like modern garage attached to this old house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's ways – I mean, to do these things that are sympathetic to the house and to the neighborhood.
I did a story a couple of years ago. The Owens, who live on Church Street, Joe Woody, who does a lot of renovations, and I've written about him in the magazine as well. But I think they were the first house to do like a substantial expansion when that district became like a historic district. Mm-hmm. And so they really paid close attention to make sure like – even like the window trim and everything, you know, looked like the rest of the house and kind of fit in. And it costs a lot more money to do that in some cases because, you know, you're not just putting up what's cheapest or whatever, you know, you're having to really put in high quality stuff and make sure things really look.
But it ensures the value of the house.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, too, I always think if you expand on a house, you don't want it to look like you expanded on the house, right? Mm-hmm. Like you want it to look like that's how it's always been.
Yeah.
And so they did a really good job on that. And I'm sure you encourage people.
For sure. And yeah, I mean, sometimes it can cost more, but historic homes appreciate faster than modern homes. Mm-hmm. And they hold their value better during recessions.
Yeah.
So it's a good investment to make.
Yeah.
And like I said, I mean, educating people to know going into it. It helps to know like, hey, this house is in a historic district. Mm-hmm. And so we try to, let realtors know, people who are looking at these houses and things like, this is part of a historic district and these are the guidelines, and they're not super restrictive. I mean, again, we understand these are people who need to live in these homes. They have families and all that stuff. But it's not any worse than having a covenant and a development.
It's like
in the suburbs. I mean, like, they're not restricting your paint colors. You can plant the plants. It's just, are you trying to make a material change, or, you know, are you adding a fence? Are you changing your porch? Do you want to take your siding off and put a party plank, you know, like, or put vinyl windows in when you have the original leaded glass? There's stuff like that. And again, it's not to make you feel bad or anything like that, or to call you out. It's just maybe you don't realize that you have these original leaded glass windows and that they're super rare and they're valuable, and you could put a storm window over it instead and have the same benefits, the energy efficiency, but keep these original windows that are super important to the history of the house.
Yeah.
A lot of times, like I said, it's just the people don't know.
Right.
They might not know.
Do you worry about, like, you mentioned how well houses were built, you know, years and years ago, and how you and I have something that's sloped a little bit, but it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
So many times, and this isn't the case with everything, but so many times it feels like now these neighborhoods go up with new homes so quickly and so fast, and they're not made of the same stuff that the old houses are made of. I mean, are those houses going to be here in 50 to 100 years? Do you think about
people complain about the maintenance of historic homes now, but I think the maintenance of those homes is going to be
– yeah.
A lot trickier.
Yeah.
50 and 60 years from now. Because even I mean, personally, I've bought, you know, pine at the store to build a project.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, it started shrinking. The wood started shrinking.
Oh,
and there's seams everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's like, there wasn't. It was nice and tight when I built it. But
right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just – and especially now during the pandemic, because, you know, these materials are hard to find. So, yeah, everybody's rushing to get these materials and build with. So,
yeah,
I think it's definitely, I mean, the craftsmanship and the time that it took. And it might not be for every house. I mean, there are houses, if you go in a rural area and it's a farmhouse and it wasn't built by a builder, it was built by a farmer, you know, who might not know, have known what he was doing. And so, yeah, there might be issues trying to bring that to code or save parts of it even. And I mean, the big thing is a lot of these old houses, it's the additions. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of proof to this is, you know, you have a 1910 or 1920s house, and then they put an addition on in the 50s, and they put another one on in the 70s. Well, mm-hmm. when you go to look at it, you're like, oh, this house is in terrible shape. Well, it's not. It's the additions because the quality of the material wasn't as good, or the craftsmanship might not have been as good. Where you might have to take those additions off. And that happens a lot with these historic homes.
Really? Wow.
You take those additions off because oftentimes they were kitchens or bathrooms, rooms that they might not have put into the house or made as large back then because you didn't have the appliances and things. So a lot of times those have to come off. Mm-hmm. But it is a chance to go, like you said, and put a modern addition back on that might be the same size, might be the same dimensions as the one that you took off, or it might look similar, maybe a little bit bigger. But that gives you a chance. You buy a historic home, you know, back then they didn't have open floor plans. Well, okay, you want a great room and a big kitchen and stuff. So you buy a house, a historic house, and then you can take that addition off that had the kitchen in it and put something bigger with a great room and a dining room and an eat-in and all those things that you want from your house and still retain the historic house in the front. And with the districts, that's kind of the same thing. A lot of these additions and remodels and things like that, it's just things visible from the street that are restricted. So if you put an addition in the back or to the side and you can't see it from the road, those aren't things that have to go before review.
Gotcha, yeah.
It's just physical changes that are visible from the street.
So. Well, great. Well, Trevor, where can people find more information about all the stuff we talked about today, the events, the Root House?
So you can do cobblandmarks.com, and that's got a lot of great resources about Cobb Landmarks. We have a Cobb County scavenger hunt on there that we've created. People can drive around the county and kind of find different historic sites. We have a resources section. So we actually have resources about preservation in Cobb, but then each of the cities in Cobb, because each city has their own different guidelines in their own districts. So that's helpful for people to kind of learn about the districts and if they live in one. and then roothousemuseum.com is the one for the Root House. That has information about the house, our hours of operation, our calendar of events, and then there's also a section for group tours and then event rentals. With the expansion, we recently started doing facility rentals, so we've done a couple weddings now and some showers and stuff.
And our November issue of Cobb Life has the cabin on the cover for
we've
our
been
pets issue.
Doing rentals for photography. Yeah. So we just had this past Sunday, I think 100 kids for Santa photos on the porch of the cabin. So,
oh, wow. Cool.
And again, it's just another way for us to diversify and bring in some revenue. And then also just the exposure. It's really nice. I mean, right now we're limited to 50 guests for a wedding, but it's nice to have 50 people on our site seeing the house that might not ever have come there otherwise.
And you also sell memberships, right? Like people can
We have memberships for Cobb Landmarks, and it includes the Root House. You get 20% off event rentals. You get 20% off in our gift shop. And then we also have some partners in the community. So with a Cobb Landmarks membership, you get buy one, get one free admission to the Gone with the Wind Museum, the Marriott History Museum, the Marriott Cobb Museum of Art. And then, like I said, you get free admission to the Root House. And then we also have a quarterly publication called The Landmarker, where we kind of keep people up to date with what programs we have coming up, but also what we're working on and what we're using your membership dues for. Like I said, we're a private nonprofit, so we don't get government, you know, funding for these things, for the Root House or Cobb Landmark. So it's all memberships, sponsorships, grants. So we really rely on the community and for their support financially.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Trevor. And hopefully we'll get back to some sort of new normal.
I'll let you know when we can have a ribbon
cutting.
Pilgrimage
2021, right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, you laugh. We start planning it in January.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sure. All right. Well, thank you so much, Trevor.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for the Cobb Life edition of the Marietta Daily Journal podcast from your local news source, the Marietta Daily Journal and MDJ Online. Be sure to pick up a copy of this month's Cobb Life magazine and visit us online for more complete details on the stories we've discussed, plus more stories that affect you and the people of Cobb and surrounding areas. Subscribe and share this podcast to get all the latest hyperlocal updates, plus great stories about what makes living in Cobb so special. or ask Alexa or Google Home to play the Marietta Daily Journal podcast for you. Share your thoughts or questions with us in the comments section or call the MDJ podcast comment line at 404-997-8655. We might even share your comment on an upcoming episode. The MDJ podcast is produced by BG Ad Group, Amy Cargus, producer, Jacob Sutherland, director. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.